Texas. Beyoncé just became the first Black woman solo artist to top Billboard's country chart, and she's joining a rich American music tradition.
A lot of people make assumptions about who makes that music and who the music is for, and I think there's so much out there in both the past and in the present that shows that there's so many different voices within this music.
Come take it to the floor now. Right on the state line of Virginia and Tennessee is the birthplace of Country Music Museum in Bristol. In 2023, they hosted an exhibit celebrating the work of old-time women musicians. Renee Rogers is the museum's head curator, and Tony Doman is the curatorial specialist. They join me to discuss just a few of the hundreds of women highlighted in their exhibition called I've Endured, Women in Old-Time Music. Tony and Renee, how did the idea for the exhibit highlighting women in old-time music come up?
It was actually a colleague that was an old-time musician herself, and she just one day was saying, you know, I think this could be a really good story for us to tell. And we all got really excited and interested in it.
And one of the main focal points of this exhibit is to really highlight the hidden histories of women that you might not know the name of. So we all know country music star names like Dolly Parton and Loretta Lynn. And we really wanted to focus on those hidden stories of names, people like Ola Belle Reid or the Coon Creek Girls or people like Sarah Ogan Gunning, just to name a few to get our conversation started.
The other thing is that we ask our visitors to give us names of people that we should be talking about that we might not have included in the exhibit. And so we have a panel in there that says, who should we include? And we're working really hard to get those people featured on our website so that we have even more women who are being recognized beyond the exhibit itself.
All of the video interviews of the 18 contemporary female musicians who we interviewed for this project, it'll have their full interviews up there. We didn't have enough space, of course, in the exhibit to include everything we wanted to talk about. So that's why we were able to create this website that's going to, like Renee said, live beyond and further engage more individuals and educate audiences on these incredible women.
Let's play a couple of examples just to whet our appetite about this kind of music. And maybe start with a woman you mentioned, Ola Belle Reid, singing I've Endured, which is also the name of your exhibit. She's a clawhammer banjo player from North Carolina. Here she is.
Well, I think I've Endured really sums up so much of what we wanted to say in the exhibit, because we're talking about the enduring legacy of women in the genre of old-time music. And what better way to do that than pick a pioneer in the genre, Ola Belle Reid herself, a song that she has written, a song that's been recorded by numerous artists well after her heyday, so to speak. And it just really sums up that legacy of women enduring through so many hardships. It always makes me think of Loretta Lynn singing about the pill back in the 70s, right? You had even someone like, I'm going to mention her name here, Jenny Lou Carson is a great example of a woman who sang with the Sweet Violet Boys, who have some very risque subject matter in their songs. So the song itself, I've Endured, is just to me, it's a perfect collation of just trying to get that feeling of this enduring legacy of women in this genre.
I saw that Dolly Parton gave you a glowing endorsement for the exhibit. Was Dolly Parton also an old-time musician who had to endure herself?
Oh, certainly. When she was first performing, really became known for performance, it was on Porter Wagner's show, and she was hired as the girl singer. There wasn't going to be more than one girl singer. There had been a previous girl singer before her who was leaving, and then Dolly was hired as the next girl singer, and that's what she was known as. But she knew that she had more in her than being that, and so she endured that persona and that idea, but she went way beyond it. And I just love the fact that she's still tied to that old music, but she's really innovated within the music and done so much with it.
You can really hear all this in Porter Wagoner introducing Dolly Parton to sing for the very first time in a show. Listen to how he introduces her. And she sings a song called Dumb Blonde, which, of course, is not about being dumb at all. Here it is.
One of the finest little gals that I've ever met. Let's give her a great big welcome as she sings a song that she had a big hit on called Dumb Blonde. She ain't no dumb blonde, though. Pretty Miss Dolly Parton. Come out.
I mean, you can definitely hear, like, every time he introduces her, it's little lady, little gal. There's definitely a perception there.
And you can hear how strong she is and who she is in that song, right?
Oh, for sure.
Talking about being the girl singer in the band, for example, Sally Ann Forrester was the first woman in bluegrass, is what she's known for. She was the first woman to play music in Bill Monroe's band, who Bill Monroe is now known as the father of bluegrass music. Sally Ann Forrester, there were no other women playing in this genre before her, and her husband went away to the war. He was in the band, and Sally Ann stepped in to fill in for her husband's place. So no one in bluegrass and all scholars even really didn't even credit her, Sally Ann Forrester, as being the first woman in bluegrass. They always just thought of her as just filling in. She's just one of the boys. I just think it's really interesting. You have these cases where women were doing the work. They were part of the band. You also have the Maddox brothers and Rose. Rose Maddox was a female musician, and she played with her brothers in their family band. You have a lot of cases where it wasn't really acceptable for a woman to go out on her own and be on stages, but it's okay if these women are with their family members. It's taken a long time for us to get past that. It's taken a really long time for women to even feel comfortable singing about things in their life. If you can go all the way back to early record producers, even deciding the subject matter of certain songs and what radio barn dance stars and early recording musicians who are women would even play, you know.
You interviewed ballad singer Sheila Kay Adams, who said that it was pretty much a dog-eat-dog world for women in the early days of trying to make money singing old-time music. She said Dolly Parton and Loretta Lynn, though, actually teamed up, and that was really rare. And they supported each other at a time when country music was dominated by men. Loretta Lynn is a favorite of mine because years ago I saw that movie, Coal Miner's Daughter, about her upbringing. Let's play just a little bit from Loretta Lynn singing Coal Miner's Daughter. Loretta Lynn is so great, and Dolly Parton. But as you pointed out, the women you've really featured in this exhibit, I've Endured, have been more local for the most part, or less known, right?
Definitely less known. And, you know, we wanted to bring out those hidden heroine stories. We also did talk about iconic and commercial success stories within female musicians. But yeah, we really wanted people to be able to have those touch points of people they might have heard of, but also to say, oh, I didn't know anything about this woman, and she had this amazing achievement, or she influenced music in this way.
So here is one of those who you did feature, Sheila K. Adams, the one who had mentioned Dolly Parton and Loretta Lynn having such a bond. This is Sheila K. Adams singing Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair. And this, she said, is a ballad that the Scottish women brought over to the mountains, emblematic of the kinds of songs they would sing from their homeland while they were often just living in small cabins, raising a lot of children, and doing some pretty hard work. It gave them pleasure to sing these.
Black is the color of my true love's hair. His face is like some rosy fair, with the prettiest face and the neatest hands. I love the ground whereon he stands. So fare thee well, my own true love. Our time is past, but I wish you well. Still I hope the day will come when you and I shall be as one.
And you know, Sarah, that's a really great example of one of the things we talk about in the exhibit is those old ballads. You know, they're sung in a very, very distinctive way, you know, usually without instrumentation, just the voice. But the way that they're taught, it's called knee to knee, where the teacher is sort of repeating the song back to the student line by line, and then you're singing it back to them in a way to pass it on. And Sheila Kay is a seventh generation ballad singer. One of her cousins, Donna Rae Norton, who we also feature in the exhibit, is an eighth generation ballad singer. They've been passing those songs down generation after generation after generation, been sort of tied back to those songs from England and Ireland and Scotland. So I love those old ballads, and I really love the sound of Sheila K. Adams especially.
I want to play something by Elizabeth Cotton, who you also feature. This is Elizabeth Cotton playing the guitar and singing Freight Train. And after I've listened, tell me a little bit about her story.
When I die, Lord, bury me.
You know, what's great about hearing that version of the song is, you know, you can tell that that is when Elizabeth Cotton was in her older years. But that song was written by her when she was only 12 years old. And she got married a few years later at the age of 15 and gave up music for a long time until her husband had passed and she connected with the Seeger family, who encouraged her to use her talents publicly. And she got a Grammy at the age of 90. So I think it's just a really wonderful illustration of sort of another woman who's endured through her life to go from a 12-year-old writing that song to getting a Grammy for the work that she did in folk music and the contribution she made. And again, she's one of those women that has influenced numerous other artists.
Here's another piece. This is Sarah Ogan Gunning singing I Am a Girl of Constant Sorrow. I want to play this and then ask you a little bit about this song and her.
I am a girl of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days. I bid farewell to old Kentucky, the state where I was born and raised. My mother, how I hated to leave her. Mother dear, who now is dead. But
that is just such a haunting song. I've always heard this song played by famous men. I am a man of constant sorrow.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have heard that song. And it became really popular because of that one movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which really kicked folk music and country music back into the mainstream back in the early 2000s. But yeah, Sarah Ogan Gunning was a singer-songwriter. She sang labor and work songs from the Kentucky coal fields. And she changed the lyrics of that song, like you were just talking about, Man of Constant Sorrow, which was actually written by a man named Emory Arthur back in 1928. So she's flipping the narrative, changed the lyrics, and came out with I Am a Girl of Constant Sorrow in 1936.
Her version reflects women's familial responsibilities, which is very different than the male perspective from the original song. So it's talking about the things that she's having to do as a girl of constant sorrow in order to support her family.
Women have historically faced so many different challenges that are separate from men, right? So you've got gender discrimination, you have bias, you have financial inequalities. I mean, it trickles all the way down into women not even being able to sing or have a platform to sing and write music about the experiences that they're living.
And speaking of women singing about social justice, here is a piece by Florence Reese. She's singing about unions, and the song is called Which Side Are You On?
Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell, how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle, we know we're sure to win, because we've got the gun, thugs are looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Wow, did you hear her sing the lyric about we've got the guns?
Yeah, well, and that's based on a very specific experience that in 1931, she was at home. Her husband had gone into hiding because he was a coal mining union organizer, and they had armed thugs from the coal company looking for him to do him harm because he was organizing for the union. And her house was surrounded by them. And she was so upset and so mad that the story is that she rewrote a hymn called Lay the Lily Low to become Which Side Are You On? You're like, are you on the side of the working man and the working person, the working woman, or are you on the side of the unions? And that song has since become used by other social justice and union organizing efforts. And Florence went on to continue to be an activist.
And then they're also in this genre, fabulous young performers now like Amethyst Kia. Here is Amethyst Kia singing Polly Ann's Hammer. She is thrilling.
John Henry had a woman, Polly Ann, Polly Ann. When John was sick, Polly drove steel like a man, Lord, like a man. Polly, can you lift that hammer? Yes, I can, yes, I can. Swing it, I can strike it harder than any man can.
Oh my gosh, her singing gives me goosebumps.
Oh yeah, Amethyst is, she's such a distinctive voice. And this is a great example of something we talked about earlier of, again, flipping the narrative of a song. You know, John Henry is a ballad, what we call a native ballad, because it was born in America as opposed to coming over with immigrants from England, Ireland, and Scotland, telling the story of the man John Henry, the still-driving man. But Amethyst has taken that story and flipped it to tell it from the perspective of his wife, Polly Ann. And Polly Ann, despite the fact that John Henry is basically dies doing that steel-driving work, she picks up the hammer and is able to finish the job, showing that she's as strong and as persistent and as enduring as any man.
When Polly had a small baby on her knee, held that hammer in her left hand. Ain't no one as strong as me. This is the hammer, kill John Henry. Won't kill me, won't kill me.
you know, with Amethyst, you know, she did her degree at East Tennessee State University in the old-time bluegrass and country music studies program. She has a lot of influences from that early old-time music, and you can hear it in the way she plays the banjo and some of the songs she sings and the songs that she writes. But she has innovated and gone beyond that old-time sound. She is doing really interesting things with the music that move beyond what most people would understand old-time music to be, at least. You know, she and Rhiannon Giddens and Layla McCullough and Allison Russell were Songs of Our Native Daughters. That's where Pollyanna's Hammer was first released, was on that album. And there's another amazing song by Amethyst on that album that I love called Black Myself, which is exploring her experience as a Black woman in music and just in life. And I think that's the other thing, is that a lot of people make assumptions about what old-time music, who makes that music and who the music is for. And I think there's so much out there in both the past and in the present that shows that there is a huge amount of diversity and so many different voices within this music that make it much richer than people would assume based on the assumptions that have been made around it. And Amethyst is definitely a big part of that story.
Black Myself is a Grammy. She earned a Grammy nomination for Best American Roots Song. And she won Song of the Year at Folk Alliance International a few years back for that song. So just totally incredible music from a totally incredible person and performer.
Let's play a little bit from her Black Myself. So where do you put the younger generation now in line with old-time music, right? You can sing and play and innovate with old-time music and still be part of that tradition, right?
Oh, definitely. And I'm going to give a shout-out to my friend here, Tony. She is part of that tradition. She is in a band with her husband, Virginia West. And, you know, she's helping to carry on those traditions, but also to innovate with them. And I think one of the things that we focus on in the exhibit is both that there are young musicians and, you know, contemporary musicians who are older, who are tradition bearers, who are making sure that those traditions are being carried on and remembered and not forgotten. But within that, you have women who have been in the genre for longer who are still innovating, despite the fact that we might look at them as tradition bearers because they've been in the genre for a while. And it's really exciting to see that. And it's also exciting because old-time music is so community-focused. It's very participatory. So you have a lot of people who are then sitting down, they're having jams, they're at fiddle conventions and banjo competitions, and they're really influencing and listening and hearing each other and playing together. And a lot of innovation and preservation comes out of that.
Yeah, and thanks for the shout out, Renee.
I could not say it.
Well, I also just want to add to that. Sometimes, especially in roots music and folk and the world that Renee and I both work in, kind of preserving this Appalachian culture, so to speak, a lot of the times I hear from people is that it's a threat of extinction, right? It's going away. If no one's going to pick up these traditions and carry them on, it's going to die out. But after speaking and doing so many interviews for this project with all these incredible women, I don't feel that way anymore because so many people are involved.
You know, my colleague is the folklorist Katie Clune, and she has some young apprentices who are working with people who are master craftspeople, singers and players. One of them is Elsa Howell apprenticing with Elizabeth Luprell.
Yes.
Tell me about Elizabeth Luprell.
Oh, yeah. She's an incredible example of a young ballad singer who is keeping those traditions alive. Elizabeth focuses on ballads that were once oral traditions that were before recorded music, right? They're storytelling. It's a time whenever you were sitting down and you were listening to someone sing this. Maybe it's a very gruesome song. Then you get to the end and someone's head gets kicked off. I mean, women are always the victims in murder ballads.
Yeah, it's very rare that a man is the victim and the woman's the protagonist. And it really makes a big difference when you flip that narrative. And some women have started doing that. We feature a song by Molly Tuttle, contemporary young artist, called The River Knows, where she sort of tells the story from the woman who's gotten her revenge rather than having a man take her life or do something bad to her.
Every day I was so tall till we were 16. In a year he towered over me. Thought he was a friend indeed, but a woman can't trust a man in need. Down on the muddy banks where the roses grow, the river cries.
Ooh. Yeah, and murder ballads, they're very violent deaths, you know? And I think, you know, women are kind of sick of being the victims. So there are a lot of women who are flipping that narrative, writing about a perspective where they come out alive.
Even Patsy Montana did it, and that was like in the 1930s and 40s we're talking about. She turned the narrative on one of those songs where the woman was sort of the protagonist of what happened to the men as opposed to the other way around. And that's, to me, that was also unusual because that was happening quite early.
Well, Renee Rogers and Tony Doman, thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Oh, we've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation.
My guests were Renee Rogers, the head curator at the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, and Tony Doman, their curatorial specialist. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Ballad singing is a sophisticated art form. It dates back to the 16th century and is alive and well throughout Appalachia. Elizabeth Leprell is a banjo player and singer from Cedar Springs, Virginia. She specializes in traditional Appalachian singing. Recently, she participated in the Folklife Apprenticeship Program as a master ballad singer. This week, we're taking you to Rural Retreat, Virginia, where Virginia Humanities Folklife team sat down with Elizabeth to learn more about the significance of ballads.
So as a young teen, my dad found an album online called Ballads from the British Tradition. It's part of a series that the Library of Congress put out of Alan Lomax's recordings.
Oh, you must answer my questions nine. Sing 99 and 90, or you're not going.
Alan Lomax visited, among many others, Texas Gladden in her home in Salem, Virginia.
What is whiter than the milk? Sing 99 and 90, and what is softer than the silk? And you are the weaver's bonnie.
She mainly got recorded maybe the 1930s through the 50s, in her log cabin. And I just wanted to learn all of her songs. So I got to know Texas Gladden's daughter and granddaughter. Her daughter, Alma, has passed away now, but her granddaughter, Vicky, has these lovely memories of her grandmother, Texas Gladden, singing to her and rocking her in a big squashy armchair. And for me, that connection between these old songs that are like, you know, maybe sitting in an archive or on a compact disc and you can hear this singer almost as a relic, right? Then to go and have the music be the connection that leads you to a real friend. That was such a beautiful moment.
And you were the weaver's bonnie.
And this is like a little tidbit from an interview, right? When Texas Gladden says, like, I can remember every person that I learned a ballad from. And when I sing the song, that person pops up. So now when I think about Texas Gladden songs or I go to sing one, then I can see, I have a picture of her home, a lot of jam and canned tomatoes, like all in jars, you know, sitting in this special shelf that her husband built for her. I know that she liked to collect little knickknacks. I know that she wrote poetry herself. You know, her family kind of liked romance books, like historical romance, which is like, of course. And this, you know, I just think like that's also why she remembered these songs and made a point of going out to like learn them and then sing them for her friends.
What is louder than a horn? Sing 99 and 90. And what is sharper than a thorn? And who is the weaver's bonny?
Ballad singing as a way of entertainment was really mostly happening, this is my guess, really mostly happening inside homes and like in family or close neighbor groups. Or actually, Texas Gladden also talks about she had, when she was young, friends at a factory that she worked with, and then she would sing to those people, and they would like, they would be like, sing that old love song because I'm having, you know, boy problems.
Oh, I'm just a poor girl, my fortune is sad.
But I think that that context of like wanting a song or a story song particularly that like one person knows and can tell really well, even the radio, like not even TV, but when the radio came into the home, that started to kind of lose that, okay, here we are, it's night, we're done with our chores for the most part, we want to relax but we're not going to sleep for a little while. That period of time is kind of filled with other ways to entertain each other now. And so I think it started to sort of filter away as a sort of everyday thing.
He works for a living. His money's his own. And if they don't like it, they can leave him alone.
Oh, and now it's an interesting sort of conundrum to like do a like stage performance of them. Cause like when people want to go to do entertainment and sit down and listen for like an hour or something, it's not necessarily just like solid words from one person for an hour. Listeners kind of, I think modern listeners at least, like need a little bit of break. There's some kind of difference that is between like when you're informal and in a living room and like people are getting up for coffee, maybe whiling away the time with chatting back and forth. Oh, they'll be like, oh, now you do one.
Yonder comes a little man riding by, says, old man, your horse will die. Hop, 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 old rabbit, hop.
Which well, in Ireland actually is still going on. People will gather together for a night of singing unaccompanied songs, and maybe they're at like a pub and you can stop and go get a drink, and it's everyone has a song to bring.
Hop, 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 old rabbit hop.
And that's very different from a stage performance. That's still sort of a quandary for me of like how to put the ballads across, because I like them as they are. I like them unaccompanied. How to get them across in that different context is really interesting to me.
I'll get old Jack and put him on the track. Ride that rabbit to thunder and back. Hop, 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 old rabbit, hop.
I think actually Texas Gladden was thinking about some of the same things because she talks in these interviews about like how her friends would be like, sing me this old love song, you know, sing me one of these sad love songs. That's what her audience at the time was in the mood for. And then she talks about how she raised 9 children. So she talks later to Alan Lomax about like, I've been singing lullabies. I haven't sung these old ballad songs in years now. So it changes. Yeah.
Go to sleep, go to sleep, go to sleep, you little baby. When you wake, have some cake and ride them pretty little horses. A black and a bay, a sorrel and a gray, a whole heap of little horses. A black and a bay, a sorrel and a gray, a whole heap of little horses. A little old.
I think there is an idea kind of floating around that ballad singing is a women's art, and yet there's lots of male singers. And so I've wondered this many times, like, were more women doing it? Or were more women at home when collectors stopped by because they were just at home more? Did more women choose singing or tend to practice singing more in the home because in Appalachia, for a lot of that period when the songs were getting collected, there was actually quite a stigma about instrumental music, especially the fiddle, and how sinful it was, and that the times you would go out to play fiddle would be for sinful dances where people were dancing. And banjo similarly, et cetera, et cetera. So women were discouraged, I think, from playing that instrumental music. I'm really interested in women's stories. I'm interested in what women's lives were like, especially from the times that these songs were being collected. That's just part of what I've chosen to have an opportunity to teach more and like what to pass on. That's been partly just a feminist praxis kind of choice for me.
There was a knight and a lady gay. She sent them away to a far country to learn their grammar.
As to why they're important, why are ballads important? Just because they're good art is my best. You know, they've been... People have been like hearing them and thinking, wow, that's really cool. I hope that I can remember this, and like either writing it down or recording it or setting it down in some way for hundreds of years now. It's like some of the oldest poetry actually in modern English that's out there. These songs really belong to everyone. That's one of the beautiful things about them. It has made so many journeys through time and space.
Was on a cold, cold Christmas night when everything was still. She saw her 3 little babes come running.
Elizabeth Leprell is a banjo player and singer who specializes in Appalachian singing. She'll share more of her songs and stories at the Richmond Folk Festival, coming up October 13 through 15. After finishing law school, my next guest, Jane Henderson, was looking for a way to pay off her student loans. So she called her dad, renowned guitar maker Wayne Henderson, and asked if she could help him make guitars. And Jane never went back to the courtroom. She's a full-time luthier in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of the few women luthiers in the world.
I have a little shop here in Asheville, North Carolina. It's my basement. We built a shop and then put a little house on top of it. You know, I have a little bench. It's really not much. I've got a bench and a couple of pretty cool, like, saw stop machines that I'm kind of proud of. Every year, my dad for Christmas will give me a new machine. You know, but I'm full up at this point. Well, I've got them all.
What mountains are near you?
Just Appalachian Mountains. We've got Mount Mitchell, which is one of the, isn't it the largest? Or is it Mount Rogers? The ones I'm closest to are one of the largest on the East Coast. But yeah, Appalachian Mountains run from here up to Rugby, Virginia, where my dad lives, and beyond.
You make beautiful acoustic guitars and ukuleles. What sorts in particular?
So my dad, Wayne Henderson, he's pretty well known. He's been obsessed with Martins for his whole life. Pre-war 30s, early 40s Martins are just the holy grail. Dreadnoughts, which aren't really my scene, but I love the traditional aesthetic of an old Martin. And so I typically will do somewhat copies of that style, but I always put my own aesthetic on there. But I love the way they sound, and my dad taught me how to manipulate the wood in a manner that would make them sound the best.
I've always wondered what is entailed with manipulating the wood to give it that resonance.
At first, you don't have anything to go on but your senses. But after a while, you kind of feel the weight. You can see if a piece of wood is going to sound good. You can sort of tell. But the best way is to tap on it and feel and hear how resonant it's going to be. And you can do that with any thickness. But if you take a piece of red spruce, for instance, and hang it just right between your fingers and tap on it, it'll make this long hum that'll tell you, you know, how well it's going to sound. You're like, oh, I know that piece of wood wants to sing. It wants to be an instrument. It can't wait.
A lot of luthiers only use exotic woods, but you take a different approach. Tell me about woods you've used.
I do indeed take a different approach. If I can use sustainable wood, local materials, materials that have been thoughtfully harvested, or if it's been reclaimed, I'm happy to use it. But I have the skills to manipulate the wood to make this instrument sound exactly, you know, how it should, and give that wood the best tone it can. But I also have this love of the environment and love of preserving our natural world. So I don't want to promote cutting down exotics and, you know, having a huge carbon footprint and decimating rainforests. Yes, trees do grow back, but we have to plant them, and it takes a long time. So we need to be really cognizant of what we're cutting down and where and when.
What sort of local woods work for you?
Walnut is probably one of my absolute favorites, black walnut. I love red and white oak. I've used them, and they make surprisingly good instruments.
I don't know whether it's for the body or the top, but you've even used the wood sassafras.
I have. Someone brought, or I guess it was a big hunk of sassafras. I got it from a friend in coal country, Virginia. Sassafras shouldn't grow as large as it did, but they had this board, and it was large enough to make a soprano ukulele, and I made the whole body out of it, top, back, sides. It was a special instrument. It smelled really good. It smelled like root beer.
I love sassafras.
It sounded incredible, like, you know, but I love using things like that.
How does somebody get on the list to get a Jane Henderson guitar or ukulele?
The easiest way is to just get in touch with me. Send me an email. I have a list of interested people. You know, some people wait several years. I have maybe a 3 or 4 year wait list. If the folks waiting longer get in touch with me, every December, I open my books for that following year. So if you want an instrument in 24, get in touch with me this December. And if no one's been waiting longer, then, you know, I give preference to whoever's waited the longest, but I have 10 slots.
You're known for so many things, but one of them is your artistry with the inlay on these instruments. Tell me about your joy in doing the inlay.
I don't know, I'm a girl. I like sparkly things, number one. But mostly, I just, my mom is an incredible artist. My dad's an incredible artist, obviously, too. But that itch to create manifests itself in the inlay and in the aesthetics of the, I love doing sunburst color. But the inlay I like because it doesn't affect the sound. It's just a little extra something that makes it really special for a specific person.
Do people ask for different patterns?
Oh, yeah. And that's another way that I get to know people. I love being able to hear people's stories. So I've inlaid my friend's goat, Dee Dee, one of her first goats. She and her husband were very high-powered political folks in Chicago, and they moved to the middle of nowhere near my dad to be goat farmers. They just kind of like, well, we're done with that. We're going to go do this now. And her first goat is named Dee Dee. And so I inlaid Dee Dee on the back of her peg head. And I also did an inlay of kudzu for her. I made her a ukulele because goats love to eat kudzu. And then I've done so many animals, and the wood on my ukulele came from my friend Paul, who was the surgeon on Kauai. So I had to keep it.
Oh, you have a wood connection on Kauai?
I have several wood connections in Hawaii. I made friends with a fellow, he was the surgeon on Kauai. He emailed me and said, hey, I'm an amateur ukulele builder. If I paid you to come out, would you teach me inlay? You know, you could stay for a week and just teach for a couple of days. And I've got ukulele builder friends. Would you be willing to come out if I gave you a place to stay and flew you out here? And I was like, I mean, what kind of trick question is that? So we did.
Are you kidding?
We came out and I made friends. I traded him red spruce and some maple and just things that I have here. And he traded me this insane, beautiful koa. But he reminds me when I went to Maui to teach inlay again and met even more of these incredible local native Hawaiian guys. It was amazing. Even though it's a teeny tiny island in the middle of the Pacific, it's so similar to how my dad grew up. They grew up so similarly. You know, their moms made their own shirts. My granny used flour and corn sacks, and Edmund's mom used rice sacks, you know, and they had the outside to entertain themselves. They both played in the same type of creeks and played with the same gang of kids. And I loved that. I loved feeling so connected when I was there.
I also love how you came to be in this profession. You didn't start out with a goal of becoming a luthier. You were in Vermont training to be a lawyer.
Yep, I absolutely had no plan of this. I got a degree in environmental law and policy from Vermont Law School and decided those loans cost a lot of money. And so I was like, dang, how do I pay this back? Well, my dad's guitars sell for a lot on eBay. Maybe I could just, hey, Daddy, can I make one and sell it on eBay? He was like, you know, sure, I'll give you all the nice stuff, but you have to come in here to the shop and work on it every single day. You know, I'm not going to do it for you. You have to do it. And I thought that would be hard work and unpleasant, but it was absolutely the best time I've ever had.
How did that first guitar you made with him turn out? What did it sell for on eBay?
The first guitar sold for $25,000.
Oh my gosh.
I paid
really?
For, I made another one and out of koa, which is one of my favorite woods. It's Hawaii. It only grows in Hawaii. That one brought 20, and I used that to pay for my rent for my AmeriCorps year. And then the one that I, with my name, the very first one with my name, I didn't eBay that. I just, you know, told folks, but it was $5,000 that was just with my name, my first guitar.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And you were hooked.
Yeah. There were so many things that made me feel that I couldn't do this. But my husband made me feel that I could, which I really appreciated.
How many women luthiers are there?
Not many. I have several close friends who are luthiers, but again, not many. And I've connected with most of them on Facebook or social media, Instagram.
It feels like the women artists and the women museums ought to be coming to the Women Luthiers, right?
Yeah, I would love that. There are 60 members of my Lady Luthiers group, and a lot of them that's all over the world. I've talked to one in Ireland. My friend Heidi is in Prince Edward Island. She lives up Nova Scotia area. Kathy Wingert lives in California. She's incredible. Linda Manzer and Peggy White are up in Canada. Those are sort of the bigger ones. It's a small club of us.
I love that. What are you working on now?
Right now, I have two ukuleles. Just on Friday, I shipped a soprano ukulele made out of walnut, full body walnut, which was, oh, it sounded so good. It was one of my favorites. It's always sad. I love them. You know, I get to know these beings as I'm working on them. And they, you know, they say their first words with me. And I just get so excited to send them to their people. But I also am sad as well because I love them. Each one individually is a special being with a soul and a voice of its own. And I love being able to provide that for people. But I also some days I'm like, oh, just maybe you could stay a little bit longer.
Well, Jane Henderson, I so admire your passion, your spirit, your aesthetic. Thank you for talking with me and with good reason.
Thank you so much. It was really, really nice to chat.
Jane Henderson is a luthier based in Asheville, North Carolina. Support for this episode of With Good Reason comes from the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. This is a charitable trust created by the will of acclaimed 20th century artist Joseph Cornell that honors the memory of the artist and his younger brother, Robert. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. This episode was produced in partnership with Katie Kloon and the Folklife Program at Virginia Humanities. The With Good Reason production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.